this is Bill Teeple, and this is Icon Art Radio. And I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, as usual. And Donna brought in an article. Tell us a little bit about this article, and let's see where we can go with this one.
Well, it's an article, interestingly, it's on the financial page of the most recent issue of the New Yorker, or actually, I think, 1 week ago, New Yorker. And they're making a point about the financial health of New York City and talking about the problems going on Wall Street right now. But this woman, they cite a book that recently came out called The Warhol Economy by social scientist Elizabeth Currid. And she, in her book, her point is that the most vital and distinctive economic sector in New York is not Wall Street, but what she calls the culture industry. And she feels like New York is actually sort of threatened now because it's getting really expensive for artists to come and afford to live there. And she's worried that maybe New York, as the cultural center of the world, is in jeopardy and maybe it's up for grabs. And so in this context, she mentions that one of the main draws to New York for artists is what she calls clustering, which is you have to be where the other artists are. And this is like the scene, and it's who you know, and you can't make it unless you know other artists. But once again, our culture is changing in that respect, and people are getting to know each other electronically and not just in the same physical environment. So anyway, I thought that was a good kickoff point to talk about cultural centers, as we here in Fairfield like to believe that we're living in one of sorts, and how is that different from the cultural center of New York, and where can we go with this?
That's a good one. We could go two or three shows on this one, and it's various angles. Obviously, they're vacating Manhattan for Brooklyn. That's the hot place, and mm-hmm. that's an example of what always happens in every art center, that maybe they're clustering there because the art industry is there, the museums, the writers, the galleries, and the artists are all together networking, which I think networking and the cross-pollinization is very necessary in the growth of the arts. But they will always find the cheapest. I mean, they're not, artists are interested in being nourished by their art and communicating through their art, the pure artists, and that they're living, spending a fortune on rents, keeping you from being able to, so you have to work on something else and not be able to do your art, is not their mode. Their mode is to find a place where they can live the cheapest, do their art, network, and live amongst other artists, and see what happens. And things start happening there, and then the gentry move in and buy it, raise the prices, and the artists find somewhere else. Brooklyn is the hot place out there right now, I understand. But I think with our networking capabilities with the internet, the world is changing. We're a global village now, and artists are connecting. I check the internet all the time to find new artists and find out what's happening globally in the art world. And I will download images and have files of things going on. And if mostly I'm interested in Iowa contemporary art, but I'm networking more and more with Iowa artists via the email and internet, and then I'll go out and visit studios, other places. And on the other hand, artists are drawn to a place where the edge of creative thinking exists, mm-hmm. so that we can redefine the new form of things together. And I think one of the most interesting places for artists to consider coming for that reason is Fairfield. Because we have multiple levels of edge grazing going on here. Grazing the edges spiritually and in terms of the art forms. And we have all levels of different arts happening here. We still have somewhat of a provincial. There's everything from the very staid and small town environment to a kind of East Coast, West Coast moderate view of culture, and we have some people that are grazing at the edges here too. So it's a very interesting environment, and attractive, I would think.
This may be an impossible question to actually answer, but where do you personally see the edge right now? Is there some way that you could kind of define the edge? Is there one edge, or are there many edges, or what?
Well, we always can never see that, because you can't see the forest for the trees. So you think that you know what's going on, only to find 100 years later that you were in the rear guard and others around you were in the first guard and you didn't know it. So it's always difficult to say this. I mean, if you ask someone who really knew what was going on with art in 1890, what's really going on with art and what the edge of things are, he was probably doing some kind of very realistic rendering with some kind of an edgy topic, mm-hmm. and only to find that the art world raced past him into a realm that was inconceivable to him. So it's always dicey business to answer this question.
Well, yeah, and actually also that some of the people who themselves think that they are racing past and are the innovative forefront of the arts are possibly just in the future going to be considered silly. And
yeah, oftentimes they're repeating a pattern of infantile thinking.
Well, I think that, you know, an artist whose goal is to race past to the cutting edge of innovation is probably not a full-time artist. Mm. You know, he may be a full-time creative person, you know, with a strong sense of marketing or something, but I don't think the artist is paying, I mean, the kinds of artists that we're really talking about aren't paying that much attention to where the leading edge is.
Right.
They're paying attention to where their creativity is taking them.
Which is what she called in that article, the culture industry. Those people who want to be like the forefront innovative people are probably people who want to be at the forefront of the culture industry and have the collectors, you know.
Yeah, they want to be successful industrialists.
Yeah.
The whole concept of the culture industry is a
slightly
unsettling
area.
I mean, I'm concerned. I would just assume it all collapsed and then we could see some pure truth rising in the arts again. It is true that when Robert Rauschenberg and those guys were having little studios in Manhattan or wherever they were in that part of the world, they talked about paying $50 a month for a studio. So, I mean, and nobody cared. I mean, by the Rauschenberg's age, people were starting to care. There was a popular, the popular world was beginning to wake up to what was going on with contemporary artists in America. But with the abstract expressionists, I mean, those guys, there were about 50 of them and about 100 people cared. Yeah. And that was the art scene in New York. And that was the last truly heroic moment in New York art, as far as I'm concerned. And we've had some great moments of art expression since then. But I think that was a time when these guys were devoted to art as a kind of a religious path, a spiritual path that was a kind of religion for them. I mean, they were not enlightened, so they were kind of mixed up still in everything that was going on in their lives and with their work, but they took their work serious as a calling.
They were also conflicted in some of them anyway, in the when collectors got interested in them and offered them millions of dollars or thousands of dollars for their works, it's hard not to want to keep satisfying that. And if they've been poor for years and all of a sudden they see that they can become extraordinarily wealthy, it's hard to resist that.
And on the other hand, I think it made some of them a little sick to their stomachs and couldn't handle it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They were kind of pulled in both directions.
Definitely I would say, at the risk of saying something controversial, that from the Rauschenberg age, the Jasper Johns Rauschenberg's age on, we had people getting on board the train. And these other guys, the former guys that watched the culture industry emerge in New York, I think felt a little bit uneasy, even to the point of committing suicide. Mm-hmm. that's not exactly why Pollock ran his car off the road and Rothko committed suicide. There were other factors. But I think there was some of the depression that they describe of some of those characters, I think, had to do with this phenomenon.
Yeah, it's interesting that they have to, I mean, a lot of these artists, even the ones who are, you know, purely on an inner quest and are totally devoted to what they're doing and are not trying not to be influenced by trends and you know, gallery values and things. At the same time, they mostly need some recognition. And when vast, unexpected, out of proportion recognition suddenly is heaped upon them, or upon someone doing the opposite of what they're doing with, you know, apparently no concern for any of the values that they're thinking about, it's got to be very disconcerting. You know, if someone starts giving you huge amounts of money for what you're doing, but for all the wrong reasons, you know, you sort of have to accept the money. It's very difficult to prefer poverty, especially if poverty means you can't afford canvas and paint. But at the same time, to know that, you know, you now have this powerful influence in your life that wasn't asked for and is coming from the wrong direction.
Yeah, and once you get into that, you know, I mean, rock musicians and theater people and visual artists, all kinds of creative people have gotten to that point where they've reached that kind of success, and then everybody gets mad at them if they try something new to follow their own creative urge you know, boo them off the stage or say, why are you offering these paintings when what we want are those other ones?
Yeah, do more of the blue ones.
Well, and every artist, this is age old. This goes back to the cave paintings. Probably goes the artist having to compromise his work for various reasons, you know, the prostitution of one's art and all that. It's always been, artists have always been conflicted on this front. Mm-hmm. I just think that when it gets packaged, becomes an industry, becomes a factory of art objects that are channeled to a consumption economy of people that don't really quite get the philosophical underpinnings, that you're in trouble, and that artists always, they feel uneasy and they go somewhere else where they can have a more pure playing field to work off of.
Well,
their motivations are very important here. If their motivation is finding truth within themselves and giving expression to it, which motivates the purest of artists, fine. But if that person is in the game, and what they really need is adulation and praise, and this, and they have some lack where they need, you know, security. So they, and also they get, you know, you grow up and have a family and stuff, and you want to be good by putting your, you know, a roof over the heads of your family and feed them and send the kids to school. These are all valid things for human beings, except if they start to take a forefront to the initial reason for making art, then you're doing art for another reason, and you can get these things, and the industry serves all of this. But most artists, as I said, that are in the game to advance what they feel the truth of art is, usually seek out a place where they can get away from all of this other stuff and actually move their art forward. At which point you started to say something,
well,
and I interrupted
I
you.
To ask
and shall I interrupt you again?
No,
and
no.
I looked it up.
That's okay. I don't mind the interruptions. I was going to ask a question, but first I want to say something else that what you just said reminded me of. This woman who wrote the book, The Warhol Economy, her solution to what she sees as this cultural dilemma in New York City is creative subsidies. She feels like the city itself should pay artists to live there and be creative. So bringing back kind of the patron system, only having the government kind of. And so I think that's a great
idea.
As long
as there aren't any nude people, or suggest,
Well, and also because then are you beholden to creating art that New York City is going, you know, that whoever gives you the money and whoever's providing you with the subsidies, what kind of control are they going to want to have over what you produce? And so
right.
there are complications in that.
I think, though, that that's fine at the level of cities and communities, because so what if New York ends up subsidizing some kind of unacceptable New York commercial art that's funded by the city, and all the real artists know that this is terrible? Great, you know, if they're making art and some people are hating it, that's fine. You know, it doesn't hurt anybody, and there's more, you know, art money in circulation for artists.
Yeah, I think it's
artists.
I think it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Is the town going to do this or not? Is the choice?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was probably a lot of outcries
things.
When the Pope forced Michelangelo.
Yeah.
To paint the Sistine ceiling. He probably thought this was nuts and didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
The other people probably thought it was nuts. The guy should be doing more sculptures, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he
We're
may have made
him
even
to do
greater
Moses.
Sculptures. What's that?
We forced him to do the Moses.
That's right.
We ended up
so
with horns.
This is not a new phenomenon. This
yeah.
is not
yeah.
a new issue. It's the issue of the patron and the artist. And when I think the best things happen when the patron creates a ground where the artist can go anywhere he will, go where he needs to go, and the patrons don't get too involved.
Yeah,
that's the best.
It's always a balance, because it's nice, at least for me, being creative. It's more fun to be creative if the thing I'm creating has some kind of target. If I'm completely on my own, I'll continue to come up with creative things to do, but they won't be as satisfying as when they're also solving some kind of problem or making some kind of contribution to someone else's interest or need. And, you know, I mean, if you subsidize artists and then finally all the artists in the area who are not subsidized, you know, rise up and protest, wonderful. You know, there's some more chemistry, there's some more, you know, creative energy going into circulation, and it's going to benefit everybody to think about, well, gee, have we really been, you know, commissioning stuff that all looks the same to someone? We thought it was quite nice, you know. Mm. And if it's municipal or sponsored, then it's always going to take on some of the color of the sponsor. But at the same time, the artist who's being sponsored has that extra element of being able to please a specific audience and use his creativity in that focused way. And if he doesn't like that kind of work, then of course he won't get sponsored.
Well, and also the artist, like Matisse, is a good example here, because he had patrons, especially this very wealthy Russian man who kept, you know, just wanting him to crank out paintings for him. And very often he would have a certain thing in mind when he commissioned a painting, and Matisse would just take it in, you know, he couldn't help himself, he would take it in another direction, and the Russian man was open-minded enough to see that what he had done was far more exciting than what he had thought he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So innovations took place through that patronage that were unexpected.
Well, I think it's an absolutely essential marriage, mm-hmm. in the flourishing of arts, that you have this patron-artist relationship. We're talking about different values, whether the city is the patron, whether a rich count is the patron. There has to be that. And in democratic America and business-like America, we have art galleries, that, and we have a middle class, pretty much public and today, that buys art in art galleries and puts these things in their homes over the couch. And it's perfectly... Or they turn their home into a museum if they're more serious about it. But there has always got to be this dialogue. And sometimes the artist is more making the piece by himself in the studio for its own essential reasons in terms of the dialogue between the artist and the work. But in many cases, he's making it for the effect it will have on this audience or the patron,
sure.
or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all the lively interplay that goes into the art making, and the purpose of art for society. All of this goes together.
So this is the question I was going to ask some time back. What examples can you give of times in history or cultures where art, the whole tradition of art was very, very pure and was not mixed with commerce at all, or very minimally. Is there?
and when those times existed, was it even called art?
What? Yeah, we've, this thing, art, that we're describing, this is a phenomenon we could have a show about. This thing called art and the idea of, I don't know, the artist community is really something that's gone on between the 1300s and there are critics today, Arthur C. Danto and the other one, who have both written books about the end of art. Well, they don't mean the end of creative expression. They mean this period we call the art period, when people were making art. I think they talk about a beginning around the 1300s and ending about the time of Andy Warhol with the postmodernist period. And now we're flailing around, because if it's the end of art, what are we doing? Well, that's a very good thing to redefine.
Sure.
And get the name out of it.
Yeah. Well, and maybe, you know, what we loosely think of as the Fairfield School, where, you know, art is an activity oriented around personal growth or inner growth. Maybe, in fact, it's the inner growth that's relevant, and the art is a symptom of how certain kinds of people pursue inner growth.
And so I will answer your question now, because he just said it. The cutting edge of art today has to do with its expression of advanced inner growth and living a holistic life. It's a spiritual thing.
Is this a kind of expanded spiraling of times in history prior to the 13th century, when art was mainly for the church, when artistic expression, they weren't even, and a work of art was not even signed by an individual.
No, it was
the frescoes, right, and the, you know, expressions of devotion and all that. Is it?
Artists were thought of as craftsmen, and there were guilds of craftsmen. They weren't much different. The stone cutters and the painters and the people making furniture were all looked at pretty much as artisans. Mm-hmm. And it was only with this rise of the individual, with the Renaissance, celebrating the individual and celebrating the outer field of life, and the rise of the kind of superstar artist, that we had this new kind of art culture. Michelangelo and the high Renaissance artists sort of set the standard for the superstar artists.
Well, yeah, most people consider Michelangelo to be the first modern artist.
Yeah,
technically.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you see, if seeing that as the cutting edge about inner growth and all that, do you see it moving away then from stars in the art field and possibly more collaborative art or something?
I don't know. I would like to think that the ego of the artist will step back, and his gift of knowledge will come forward.
Yeah, I think we'll see more and more of people just simply being creative in the context that has meaning for them at a given time. And, you know, they won't necessarily be doing the same thing all the time. Some people, you know, focus on one skill and other people don't. Those of us who don't always admire the ones who do. But, you know, I think that's really part of it. I mean, I don't see any difference really between doing a presentation about hearing space or sound as substance and doing an installation. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same process for me. In one case, I do more writing, and then I'm performing. And in the other case, there's no performance involved.
See, this is an interesting point, because I think that if this really is the shift that's going to take place, it's going to make it a lot easier for art appreciators, because a lot of people who do appreciate the arts have this kind of worry that, am I liking what I'm supposed to be liking? And there's some, you know, inner conflict about what I know about art. And if it's more a broader field of people who are expressing naturally their inner creativity and from inner necessity and all that, then hopefully it'll get to a point where people really can just more innocently appreciate art without worrying about this hierarchy of what's...
Well, I've said for some time now, because I've been a proponent of removing the word art from our vocabulary, that what if we remove the word art from what these people are doing and the name artist from what they're doing, then what they do has to rest on its own laurels.
Mm-hmm.
Its effect, whatever that effect is deemed to be or could be appreciated to be, is what it is. And so this can be felt directly by an observer. It doesn't need to be. You can say, well, oh, it's great because I'm an artist and I'm in this art world and you're not. And so you can't do that anymore. You can say, don't you feel this effect? And the person will say, no, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a valid response. And somebody else might say, yes, I do. But now we have a real feet on the ground kind of interaction going on. Go ahead.
Well, just, calling it art is related to putting it in the gallery. It's already, right, memorializing it and asking it to play a special role, where its actual role may be, in one case, to be pretty, in another case, to be funny, in another case, to be puzzling. In another case, inexplicably, I just wanted to do it, and I think it's cool, but I can't even tell you why, and if you think it's cool, then I'm a little happier, but you don't have to think it's cool. And all of those are things, and when you have to call them art, then the one that's funny probably won't get called art. And, there'll be certain categories of things that are creative that people will ignore because they can't. That you can't put it in a gallery or do it on a stage or put a special tag on it.
But if it knocks your socks off, it knocks your socks
off. Exactly.
And that's the bottom line.
Right.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.